It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
It's me, Ernest Hancock. On the line, we have Lieutenant Colonel, retired Air Force, Karen Kwiatkowski, and we have lots of reasons to be relatively concerned. Now, at the end of her article is the new Pentagon Papers. This is March 10th of 2004. These are things that were known. We knew that it was a lie. A lot of us in the industry, that's why Charles Goyette, you know, he lost his job at Clear Channel because he refused to support the war because he knew. Now, who's laughing loudest now? He who laughs last. And what happened, Karen Kwiatkowski, she writes this article in March 10th, 2004. And I'm going to read the last couple of paragraphs. It'll take me 90 seconds. And you'll understand where we are at and take us into this next hour conversation. Bush says he wants the truth. But it is clear he is no more interested in it today than he was 2 years ago. Proving that the truth is indeed the first casualty in war. Neoconservative member of the Defense Policy Board, Richard Perle, called this February for heads to roll. Perle, agenda setter par excellence, named George Tenet and Defense Intelligence Agency head Vice Admiral Lowell Jacoby as guilty of failing to properly inform the president on Iraq and WMD. No doubt, the intelligence community, susceptible to politicization and outdated paradigms, needs reform. The swiftness of the neoconservative casting of blame on the intelligence community and away from themselves should have been fully expected. Perhaps Perle and others sense the grave and growing danger of political storms unleashed by the exposure of neoconservative lies. Meanwhile, Ahmad Chalabi, extravagantly funded by the neocons in the Pentagon to the tune of millions to provide the disinformation, has boasted with remarkable frankness, "We are heroes in error, and what was said before is not important." Now we are told by our president and neoconservative mouthpieces that our sons and daughters, husbands and wives, are in Iraq fighting for freedom, for liberty, for justice, and American values. This cost is not borne by the children of Wolfowitz, Perle, Rumsfeld, and Cheney. Bush's daughters do not pay this price. We are told that intelligence has failed America and that President Bush is determined to get to the bottom of it. Yet not a single neoconservative appointee has lost his job, and no high official or principal in the administration has formally resigned because of this ill-planned and ill-conceived war and poorly implemented occupation of Iraq. Will Americans hold U.S. policymakers accountable? Will we return to our roots as a republic, constrained and deliberate, respectful of others? My experience in the Pentagon leading up to the invasion and occupation of Iraq tells me, as Ben Franklin warned, we may have already failed. But if Americans at home are willing to fight tenaciously and courageously to preserve our republic, we might be able to keep it. Well, how's that working out for us, Karen? Are we keeping it?
Yeah, no. In fact, I think it's been lost for some time now. We are actually, in fact, many of us who, you know, there's a huge resurgence of interest in the Constitution. Constitution Party is doing well. Conservative and liberal politicians who, you know, say, oh, I follow the Constitution.
Heck, they probably just read it for the first time.
Yeah, this is something that, oh, we should look at the Constitution and see. It's a dead letter. What are we talking about in the news today? Well, health care, more troops and more funding for both, more troops for Afghanistan, more funding for both of those ill-fated adventures. where in the Constitution, what would the Constitution say about these things? Well, first off, you know, Congress has to declare war. It's the only part of government that can declare war. How do we even have wars that weren't declared by God? Well, there's, you know, that's been dead since World War II. We've been in lots of conflicts, including the big one in Vietnam, which killed so many of our people, and so many more Vietnamese.
Well, since you wrote this, Tenet got the Medal of Freedom, even after they threw him under the bus.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, come on. It's so broke.
Yeah.
The one thing that I want to make sure we get up, and this is a good point, good time to do that, is the movie Why We Fight. And I thought that if you want to understand how this military-industrial complex thing is just, you know, that's the way it is, you know, that movie is a real good 2 hour of just, you know, what for? You know, and are you an endorser of that movie?
Oh, yeah, I think he did a good job. I was surprised that he included as much of my footage and interviews as he did, but he did a great job in organizing a whole movie. And it's not even 2 hours. It's less than that. It's something you can sit and watch pretty easily. But he organized it around that speech that you quoted at the beginning, Eisenhower's farewell speech, where he talked about the power, potential power of an unchecked defense industrial, and in his draft he had said congressional complex, a defense industrial congressional complex. And that congressional part is really important because all of us patriotic Americans, you know, us red-blooded flag wavers, okay, we know that you can't build an aircraft carrier without factories contributing from all of the 50 states. You know, you can't build a B-2 bomber without contributions from all 50 states. And in many cases, contributions from
every congressional district.
That's right. It's not just, oh, you know, the defense industrial people, all these corporate suits sitting around trying to think up wars that they can sell more bullets to the government. Okay, it's not just that. I'm sure that they do think about how they can sell more bullets to the government, okay? These are the fattest contracts with the loosest loosest requirements, I mean, as far as productivity, that you'll find. You won't find them in the civilian sector.
Congressmen have been going to jail for this stuff. To jail.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, this is the one thing I want to get. This is a good time to put this in too. I have pulled up on Eisenhower's speech. I've watched it in its entirety now a couple of times, but you really get a lot of it too if you read it. And the one thing that it really caught me, and a lot of people, it even as much or probably at least as much as this military-industrial complex thing, was something else that he said. And I'm going to read it real quick here. It says, akin to and largely responsible for the sweeping changes in our industrial military posture has been the technological revolution during recent decades. Now, this is 59, 60 when he's given this, right?
Yeah.
So in this revolution, research has become central. It also becomes more formalized, complex, and costly. A steadily increasing share is conducted for, by, or at the direction of the federal government. Today, the solitary inventor, tinkering in his shop, has been overshadowed by task forces of scientists in laboratories and testing fields. In the same fashion, the free university, historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research. Partly because of the huge costs involved, a government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. For every old blackboard, there are now hundreds of new electronic computers. The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment project allocations and the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded. Yet in holding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific technological elite.
Wow.
As much as everybody complained about the military-industrial complex, I saw that and I'm going, that at least was as much a threat to us as anything else. It's collective, consolidated worship of the state, function for the state of the most brilliant minds for the state.
Sure, sure. What he's describing is the parasite that grows so massive, you know, that it's almost ready to kill the host, but it hasn't killed the host yet. Now, the host, I would think, is the republic. And I actually think that it has been it's gone past the point of no return. I don't think you're going to see a national, federal, state type headed in Washington, D.C., back to a constitution, calling itself a constitutional republic. I think that's not going to happen. We have not had that for some time, and we're not going back to that. If there's going to be a republic or a Republican, small-R Republican tradition in this country, it's going to happen through states and through regions that basically, as you say, every day 100 times, declare their independence. That's what's going to have to happen. I mean, it's not, it's a hopeless cause, and I think if we can recognize it, that will help us see others that think the way that we do and kind of greet the future a little bit, because it is not going to be put back together.
No, I'm with you, sister, but I'm telling you, we have to understand it first. And that's what we're trying to do here on Declare Your Independence and helping me do a great job of that. Karen Kwiatkowski, we'll be right back.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and Karen Kwiatkowski. And I just had the extra time to push the button and put all of this stuff up on Freedoms with an S, freedomsphoenix.com, archive for today's show, the whole printed text of Eisenhower's speech, the video link to the speech. We have Karen Kwiatkowski's previous shows. We have her article from Salon.com. We have the new Pentagon Papers, her appearances in different movies. We have. It's all right there. Share it with your friends because importante. Now, I want to ask you a couple of things here. It's been building up. I want to make sure we get to. How come there hasn't been a book from you? What the heck, man?
Well, you know, people have suggested that, but I really don't think there's enough there. And I'll tell you, the Salon piece that you're talking about in the spring of 2004 was really a condensation of something I wrote in three parts for The American Conservative, which came out in December and January 2003. They ran it in three different issues, The American Conservative. And that was the detailed version, very long and detailed. And then I shortened it and updated it. Well, didn't really update it, but just shortened it and put it in a more a style that Salon would like, because they asked me to do that. So
I didn't know that the Conservative piece came out before the Salon piece.
It sure did. In fact, that's what the Salon guy, Sid Blumenthal, contacted me, and he said, you know, I like this stuff, and he'd known me before. I think he'd talked to me before, but he said the piece he did for American Conservative I like it, but it's too long for what we need. Can you condense it down? And so I worked with him to condense it down, but it was the same story. And those two things, the longer one for the American Conservative in December 2004, and then the spring 2004 thing for Salon, that was pretty much the story that I had to tell. It seemed like a lot of other folks think about the movie, Why We Fight. You know, I had a contribution in that movie. But he did a great job. Eugene Jarecki did a great job putting that together to kind of tell a story that I certainly agreed with that needed to be told. So, you know, it seemed like there's information out there, and I didn't have enough for a book, and that's why there's not a book.
Well, there's a bunch of stuff after. Well, let's put it this way. There needs to be a movie of the week on Karen Kwiatkowski.
Yeah, you know, there was some interest. I'll tell you, though, when Bush was in office, and that was many years, for many years, during these wars that were begun on false pretenses, and we haven't talked about Afghanistan, but that too has been begun on, you know, was begun on a false pretense. In fact, the article that I wrote for Lou Walkerell, the most recent one, the one that you we talked briefly about on Afghanistan, you read from at the beginning of the show.
Yeah, time to leave.
Yeah, exactly. It's time. We've been time to leave for a long time, but that article says that the mission is accomplished, but I specifically point out at the beginning of that article, the mission we were told about has been accomplished. I also list in there for Afghanistan at least three missions that we were not told about that are counterintuitive in many ways for the average American. And those missions, of course, are thriving. So there's little chance that we're going to come home.
Well, you know, I want to talk about that in a second. You know, what the other, you know, submissions are in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
But before I forget, I want to ask this one question. The next movie, if you go on to a list of movies, there's databases and so on, and your name come up, all of a sudden, boom, man, there's like 5, 6, 7 movies you're in. And I'm going, wow. And then there's one that's called Superpower. I haven't even seen that one. I never even heard of it. What's that?
I don't know. I'm sorry. I really haven't watched all the movies. Why We Fight, I've seen a couple times.
That's a good one. That's grade school should be seeing that one. No. Superpower. I haven't even seen it. I didn't even know it existed.
I haven't either. I'm sorry. I can't comment. I guess if I'm in it, it must be. No, I'm just kidding.
Of course it is.
Actually, I probably have the CD, but I don't like watching myself. And plus, I do sometimes watch these movies. Why We Fight, I did watch, and I enjoyed that one. Some of the others, you know, have a little more of a. I mean, for example, Michael Moore.
A partisanship kind of thing.
What was it, Fahrenheit 9/11? That's dated, I guess, now. But, you know, there's a political agenda there, only part of which I really, you know, agree with. So, and I'm not in that one, of course. But that movie tells a story, but there's a little bit of an agenda.
Yeah, a lot of these have that way. Well, one thing I do want to, I want to go into Afghanistan because you know more than most. So I'm going,
well,
okay.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I know more than some people, but I think a lot of us actually know. But I'll just tell you this about Afghanistan, and it's available for anybody that wants to know it. The Taliban, who we now are supposedly fighting against, although we're still paying them off, so I don't know if we're friends or foe, but basically the Taliban were taking bin Laden's money in return for providing him safe harbor, which they did, and then 9/11 happened, so we say, well, we got to strike at somebody. Bin Laden's in Afghanistan, and the Taliban are protecting him, so we'll take them out. Well, 3 months before 9/11, in June of 2001, Colin Powell was in Kabul or some central location. I don't know if he was in Kabul or in another place, but he presented a financial award to the leaders of the Taliban who were running Afghanistan for finally making really massive progress on eliminating the opium agriculture that goes on there. Why was the Taliban doing this? Of course, we proclaim in this country that we don't like drugs. Well, actually, we love drugs, okay? You know, the government has a business, has an agenda. There's a lot of money being laundered, okay? We love drugs. But anyway, on the surface of us, we have a prohibition on all kinds of drugs. And so that's part of our foreign policy as well as our national policy. And we were giving bonuses and awards in recognition to countries that could bring drug manufacturer growth, the case of the poppy, under control. Why was the Taliban doing this? Because they're, you know, fundamentalists, and they view drugs the way a Southern Baptist views alcohol, except actually probably more strict than the way Southern Baptist views alcohol. In any case, we were friends with the Taliban also that summer in spring, as had happened in previous years. Taliban in full dress, religious garb, were a routine picture in Houston. Why were they coming to Houston? Well, because we're trying to work a pipeline deal with them, and these are the guys running the country. Did we care then that, you know, that they didn't let the women have any rights, or that they were kind of corrupt and didn't have a democracy?
Well, there were a lot of female reporters that tried to make a big deal out of it and grandstand and this and that, and these guys are going, hey man, we came here to make a deal.
That's right.
Women talk to us.
The policy was, under the same exact administration that declared war, well, they didn't declare war, they made war without any declaration, but the same administration that made the war on Afghanistan and made the war on the Taliban was also the same ones that absolutely loved them, were deep in bed with them.
Now, that's why they went to Texas.
Yeah. They knew where power was. And so anyway, that's a little bit of the history. Second off, we don't arrange assaults and mobilize for war just off the cuff. The planning, I suspect, and I don't have any evidence of this, but the planning, I suspect, for an invasion or a toppling or at least an attack, a change of government in Afghanistan, actually, I think we were looking at that before 9/11, and 9/11 happened to be a good excuse for it.
There's oil the Taliban, needed to be taken from where? Yeah, Caspian Sea to the Indian?
Well, the Transcaucasus area and some of the former stands of Russia have gas fields. They're building a gas pipeline, not so much oil, but gas. And this gas pipeline ran from the west to the southeast across a section of Afghanistan that was the last little bit that the Northern Alliance held and the Taliban didn't control. So the Taliban is the government in charge, but they can't provide or guarantee any security for construction of this pipeline that was going to go into Pakistan and then out the port there, Lahore or someplace in Pakistan. So this is a pipeline that's been worked for a long, long time. One of the companies that had been interested in it was Unocal. Unocal should ring a bell because Hamid Karzai, who is our man in Kabul, is a former Unocal exec who worked on the pipeline deal.
You mean it was about oil? Oh, my goodness. When we come back, we'll talk about the oil in Afghanistan. Some other stuff I want to talk about, too. We'll be right back.
There are those that just want to be left alone and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Hey, let's stop, take a look around. Because, I mean, damn, girlfriend, we have a lot of things to be concerned about. And some of the people ringing the bell, sounding the siren, screaming at the top of their lungs back in the day, guys, 5 years ago. 5 years ago, right in the middle of this mess, saying, yo, over here, let me tell you what's up. And, you know, a lot of people listening, a lot of people knew, a lot of people in the media knew, but they were so deeply invested in this war. You know, I tell you another thing. A lot of times, you know, these media companies are just a PR department of these large corporations that make profit off the war anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's true. It's true. Yeah, I mean, think about GE, you know, owning NBC. I mean, come on. You know, GE, big section of what they do is selling to the government, whether it's military or non-military. So, you know, they're interested in the state, and they're interested in the state having lots of reasons to spend money, and wars, foreign policy, wars, the health of the state. There's lots of reasons to spend money. And the thing about war, which is historical, there's nothing new about it, it's been this way forever and ever, is if you threaten people, you know, and say, well, you know, our existence is at risk, you know, the state is going to protect you from something terrible and awful. If you question that, it's really almost, what are you, some kind of, you know, are you a, you don't love living, you hate your country, I'm trying to protect you here, and you're saying that I'm lying. I'm just trying to do the right thing. This is the state speaking to us, and of course it cons so many of us, you know, into conforming to what it's doing, and you can talk to people, you know, I grew up as a Goldwater Republican. I'm now kind of an anarchist, I guess, past libertarianism, I think, to some extent. And, you know, my mother, who is a Goldwater conservative and likes Ron Paul, very much a big fan of Ron Paul now, you know, very much the same as, you know, the Goldwater strain of conservatism. Well, you know, she still makes excuses for the state, okay, because that's how we are trained. If the state's doing something good, how bad could their intentions be? If they're doing it for us. Well, it's all a crock.
And, you know, that's one thing that we run into a lot is that we'll have the national security. We need to do this for national security. We need to do that for the interest of the nation. Patriotism, national security, national security. And I'm going, you know, where's the security of the individual? Where's the individual rights come in? When do we get back to where the only proper role government was not to protect the state, it was to protect us from people like the state.
That's right. But we're not going to go back there, I don't think, because there's so much money now, and this is what Eisenhower was warning about. And of course, you know, he wrote this in 59. He gave the speech in January of 60. But this is reflecting what he has been seeing as president and as a four-star general in the World War II and post-World War II. And remember what Eisenhower was doing in the interwar period between World War I and World War II. He was like a major for forever. You know, he was doing nothing. He was watching. He was like, he was doing acquisition and management. He watched the evolution of the Marshall State, and he watched it for many, many years, and he was a part of it. So, you know, he'd been thinking on these things.
Was there anything that he did after this? I mean, after he had given this speech, I mean,
yeah.
He was just a good little boy and went off and just was quiet?
I think so. Like so many. I think, well, I don't know for sure if he was quiet, but you know what?
You didn't hear a lot about it, I can tell you
and
that.
And I wonder why, because what's he saying? He's saying universities are too dependent on government grants for research, and it's going to stifle their creativity.
Well, but not too long after JFK got shot, too.
Creativity's been stifled by the state. Nobody's going to say that. He's saying he's giving us the bad news. It may be the truth. You know, and it was an early-on observation. His predictions were dead on, okay? It grew. We were not an alert citizenry, and it's not clear that just being alert would have been enough.
Well, whatever plans he had to say anything, I'm sure were quelled by the assassination of JFK.
Well, I mean, come on. You know, I'm not an expert on that at all. But, you know,
that would be
like, who's that comedian from Arkansas? He passed away. He has a little vignette
Sam,
that he does.
Sam Kennison? I don't know.
Yeah, no. I don't think it's him. But
George Carlin.
No, before, it's younger than George. This guy died in his like late 20s or something, but he had a little, Carlin's great on this too, but this one guy, this one comedian, and somebody who's listening, they probably know who it is, he had a little vignette about what happens when you get elected president. And it's really short. He says, they take you in a row and they show you the video of what really happened to Kennedy. And then you just conform. You conform.
Yep. All of a sudden, I don't have a complaint anymore.
Yeah, exactly. At that point, you do what you're told, I guess. I don't know, and I don't really. I'm not an expert on any of these.
Well, one thing before we were almost, I told you it'd go fast.
It's gone by fast. Yeah.
You know the one. Excuse me. I got pushed the button when I call. The one thing that I wanted to make sure we got to is that, you know, what preceded all of this, it really gave him a blank check for a long time that got, you know, everybody in line was, of course, 9/11.
Yeah,
and you were in the Pentagon when it was hit.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Now, yeah, I wasn't anywhere near. I was about, a third. I was probably a third of the way around from the
Pentagon. Okay, so did you feel it?
I didn't feel it. People next to me said they felt the vibration. I didn't feel anything. I heard a big boom, and we looked out our window. We had a window facing inside. We're in the B ring, which A is the center, and so we were in the second one from the center, fourth floor. So we had a view of the roof over the interior. So we heard this boom and looked out, saw this massive fireball about a third of the way around the Pentagon on the roof. And what it looked like was in the movies when they drop a bomb. It looked like something had been dropped and hit the roof and exploded. That's what it looked like. Now, that's not what we were looking at. What we were looking at was something that had impacted at some point, and this was the explosion upward. This was the gas and fire escaping above, and it wasn't on the edge of the Pentagon. It wasn't on the outside edge, you know, the E-ring. It was in a little bit, probably midpoint. Two and a half.
Now, let me go ahead. You know, we just, you know, skip to the end. The one thing that I want to ask you.
Long story short, we exited the building. We were pushed around. Our group was, we walked around with thousands of other people, and we stared at the point of impact, at the lawn. The lawn was green. There was no debris. At some point in that time of, and everyone's in shock, I'm sure, and we're all, you know, staring, the military people, they made a call for all military people or reservists to report actually down on the grass, on the ground. We were up on the highway, and so all of us came down, all the military types came down, and we lined up in groups of four for stretcher duty, which they thought they might have out that side. Of course, they didn't. They didn't have anything coming out that side as far as survivors or anything. But anyway, we were actually on the lawn, and we stood there for some time before we were dismissed. And again, no debris, no real... visible damage. What the visible damage was, of course, was to the building, and that everyone's seen the point of impact, this hole. So I don't know how big it was, but, you know.
Well, these are a couple of questions.
And the story, of course, is that this airplane, that an aluminum-nosed jet came in at that level without tipping its wings into the ground and making any gouges or breaking any wings off, the nose punctured, I don't know how many layers of concrete, and the wings, like, folded up and went in after that, into that little tiny hole and leaving no debris. Well, that defies the... I'm just telling you that's what the story was. What I saw after the point of after the attack or whatever, of course, was nothing like that. It was nothing like any plane wreck you've ever seen and ever will see.
Okay, now this is a question that I want to ask. As you're standing there with experienced, you're in the Pentagon, so there's some boys with some skills standing around you. Mm-hmm. Okay, what did they smell?
Well. I can't be the person to tell you what they smelled, but people did say they smelled cordite and stuff like that. I don't know what it smells like. It was a very acrid smell I've been in burning buildings. Like, my house burned in February, so I know what burned smells like. And what I smelled in the Pentagon was more chemically, you know, it was different. And people have said it's, there's lots of theories.
Well, I tell you this, the one thing that you were standing there, do you believe that it was an airliner that hit the Pentagon?
Well, at the time, our assumption was we left the Pentagon from watching CNN and watching airplanes fly into towers. Okay, so our sense of it was, hey, an airplane hit us. Had I not seen the other airplanes, then my sense of it would have been we've been hit by some sort of... missile or smaller projectile that punctured all these layers of concrete.
Our belief system
is based on a whole bunch of inputs, and we had just seen airplanes.
We'll talk about when we come back here on Declare Your Independence with Karen Kwiatkowski, and we'll finish up a little bit.
Roads? It's the Ernest Hancock Show. Where we're going, there aren't any roads.
It ain't so groovy when you're screaming.
Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and Karen Kwiatkowski. And I want to let you finish up on your, you know, I know you want to be careful. You know, this 9/11 thing, Pentagon plane or not kind of deal. You know, you kind of, I don't know nothing. All I know is dang it, they didn't fold up and go in that little hole.
I know that. I think I believe that. I don't believe the government. I don't believe the story, the media/government story that a commercial airliner, which is built, you know, out of lightweight metal, it's not built with any type of hardened nose cone or anything like that, would, number one, make a hole like that, and number two, collapse in, you know, it defies the laws of physics. And so that part, I don't get that part of the story. But, you know, I just think I know what didn't happen.
Well, they'll tell me what kind of impact that would have on the people that work there while you're going experiencing all this Office of Special Plan thing with their special plan, including having an excuse to have their special plan. I mean, did that enter into your thought process?
At that time, in September 11th, 2001, I didn't work in NISA, and Office of Special Plans did not exist, per se. Abe Schulsky and a couple other guys who later were assigned in or led the Special Plans Office were in the Pentagon, but I had no insight into them at all. Never heard of them. In fact, I didn't even know what a neoconservative was. I thought there were conservatives and liberals and, you know, Republicans and Democrats. I didn't really understand the various empire-oriented philosophies that were out there. So at the time of 9/11, I am not suspicious. I'm not suspicious of my government at that time. Okay, I'm just not suspicious of them. Now, 9/11, of course, was that great Pearl Harbor event that the New American Century Project for the New American Century, which is a place where Cheney and a lot of these guys, Abe Schulsky.
No, it was a who's who of the Bush administration.
Yes, it really was. And these guys had called for many years, quite openly, toppling of Saddam Hussein, something they got to do later after Afghanistan came first, because they couldn't really link 9/11 to Saddam Hussein. Regardless of that, they tried. They didn't do it successfully. The truth actually won out a little bit on that. But in any case...
No, it didn't. We fought a war.
Well, that's true.
They didn't give a crap whether you find out later.
They tried to use 9/11 to help justify. In fact, even how many years later it is, 8 years after 9/11, they've done surveys and polls of people, and many people, not all of them, and I don't think it's a majority now, but many people still believe that Saddam Hussein did the 9/11 deed. And this is, they believe it even after they're shown a picture of George Bush or a video of George Bush saying, hey, he had no connection, which George Bush did do long after we invaded
Wanted. Osama bin Forgotten hadn't even come up.
You know what it is? It's learning moments. If you teach, they tell you that if a positive or negative emotion is your experience in it, at the time as you're exposed to new information, this information sticks. It sticks. And so if you're a teacher, you want to maybe do learning games. You want to have a happy, you want to have good feelings, but bad feelings work the same way because it's this emotional.
I'll give you a good example. Here's a good example, Karen. And I remember this. It's the movie Beaches, okay, with Bette Midler. She's getting married. They're in the Justice of the Peace and everything. They just got married, and she slaps her new husband. And he goes, "What was that for?" She goes, "I didn't want you. I want you not to ever forget this moment."
There you go. Perfect. It's perfect. So we got slapped. Okay,
we got slapped. And then they told us whatever they wanted to.
Which was Saddam Hussein did it. It was Iraq. It was this terrible terrorist who had no reason whatsoever to come after us, of course. We'd never messed with their country. We'd never done anything wrong. The weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. All these things that we were inundated with after 9/11, in part because the neoconservative agencies brought in by Cheney and the Bush administration, these are the things that stick in our minds. This is what we learned as a nation, and you can't unlearn it. It's very difficult to unlearn it, and this is why the state is dangerous, because if it holds the hands of the Fourth Estate, if it holds the, if it guides the lips of the media, which is...
Heck, if you have government schools.
That's right. We have government schools and everything else, and so you're going to continually have whatever message that is useful to the state reinforced, and it's very, very difficult for people to get out from under that. So
okay, I want to get to the last part. It goes right in with this. I want to ask you this, and before we run out of time, where are we going to go? I mean, what's where we're at? Gold right now is at its highest, like 1143. I just checked a little bit ago.
Yeah, really high. Yep. That reflects all the printing that's gone on.
Yeah. That hadn't even hit yet. We haven't hit commercial real estate.
Not at all. In fact, people say, well, all you people warning about inflation and hyperinflation, you don't know what you're talking about because we don't see any inflation. In fact, I'll tell you that there won't be any belief in it in the sense that retiree COLAs, the Social Security people aren't getting a cost of living increase this year because the way they count cost of living excludes gas and food. And so they said, well, your television prices dropped and computer prices dropped, and so therefore, so they say, well, there's no inflation, but the money through the fractional banking system that's been created is in the system. May not be circulating. Many of these banks are hoarding cash, but it's in the system, and it's going to look like real money. In fact, all that money they print looks like real money, and when it hits the system, you're going to see massive. There's no way around it. I mean, this is like physics that defies the state's explanations of all the events of 9/11. Physics defies that. Okay, so what are you going to believe, physics or the government? I'm going to believe science.
Yeah, let's do math, man.
Yeah, it's the same for.
I asked somebody, a wealthy individual, and I, so where are you putting money? Where do you put money? Where do you put money? A lot of them, they're getting out of the country and precious metals, they're done.
Yeah.
But one thing, he goes like this. He says, you put it in government guaranteed cost of living increase, inflation indexed fund, blah, 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 blah.
Oh, my God.
And I'm going, wait. And that inflation index is based on what? Well, that's one of the motivations they had for changing the index is so they didn't have to give the increase on their payouts.
That's right. That's exactly
right. Even on the investments.
Devaluing the money is how they're going to deal with this massive debt that the government has accumulated. The government, because it owns a bank, it has the Fed, its own little machine for printing money, because it has the Fed, And, of course, we can't even look at the Fed, what it does, right? We can't even say, oh, we'd like to see a report from the Fed. We can't even do that, you know, and they're really afraid to look at
it. So where are we going? What's the end game here? You think, is there going to be a state that's going to, is it going to be North, South Dakota? Montana says we're now the biggest oil producer. Texas, splits off. What happens?
I hope so. I hope that's what happens. I think what has to happen now is people need to think that that's a possibility. They need to think creatively. But I think what's going to push it, and this is my opinion, is I think when the federal government either deflates or devalues our currency so much that it hurts actual states. Actual states are saying, look, I'd rather deal with China than Washington, or I'd rather deal with Brazil than Washington, D.C. Or when states go broke and they call to the federal government for a bailout, a la Schwarzenegger, they say, oh, you got to bail me out. And the federal government bails them out with worthless money or IOUs, then I think people are going to say, are you better with Washington? Is it a ball and chain? Is it your wife or is it the ball and chain? Is it a husband taking care of you or is it a ball and chain? Once we start realizing that Washington is a ball and chain, we're going to find a number of, 100 different ways to cut that ball and chain off.
Well, here in Arizona, we are per capita, we have the highest debt in the nation, more than California.
I did not know that. That's terrible.
And what happens with, our entire state population is less than Manhattan. I mean, what happened is California, of course, they're screaming and so on, but they have, big lumps of money and pension funds and so on that they got ripped off. Well, what they did is they go, we're going to pay all these people that the state owes money, all our vendors and so on like that. We're going to pay in, state of California script. And they go, fine, cool. We're going to pay our state taxes with this. And they go, oh, no, it's not good for that.
Yeah, exactly. You don't have to be that smart to see through that kind of a ploy. And I think the people in California saw through it immediately, that they'll pay you, a state employee or a state vendor, in made-up money. But when you pay your taxes, you can't return that money back to them. It's not.
How long do you think we got, Karen? What are we looking at here? I mean, a year, two, a decade? I hear people going,
I think a decade. That's what I think, but it could be less.
Really? That long? You think so?
Well, I could be less. It should be less. I don't know. It won't be probably one thing that sets it off, but what we have today as a federal, state, big state in the United States, what we have is unsustainable, okay?
Math.
It is simply, I think, you've had Charles Guyette on, and he, in his book, The Dollar Meltdown, there's a reason the Chinese be interested in reading that book.
Absolutely. And that was the conversation.
The total debt that every person or family owns is something like, $450,000. That's debt that's been taken on by our government that we have to pay back. Well, that's impossible. The average household, it's not worth $450,000. The family could sell their house, their property, their cars, all their clothes, their CDs, their electronic gear, and they wouldn't come up with $450,000 worth of
It's
value.
Like when my granddaughter, I just had my first granddaughter born a couple months ago.
And congratulations.
And I go, thank you. And I go like this, I go, hey, you know how much you owe? Got it on you? Hey, Karen, thanks for coming on. We had a great time. I told you it'd go fast.
Yes, it went by fast. Thanks for calling me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, bye. No, I'm glad you got your house fixed up. Had a little fire there. Everything's all right. It's good to talk to you. We'll be back tomorrow on Declare Your Independence. Me, Ernest Hancock. See you then.